Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
My most sensitive areas were inflamed, my extremities pulsating with tingling sensations.
Hello, welcome to Ideas in Writing. It's a kind of podcast with me, Philip Holden, and it's all about all kinds of writing. Writing you might read in books, online, on the screen, and on the stage. It's supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, not surprisingly, if you know me. And we're starting by uploading the interviews and conversations we've had so far at events we've organised in Tunbridge, mostly at the old fire station. Mr. Books is an independent bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of inspiring, imaginative and intelligent books, gifts and conversation. You can find it at mrbooks.co.uk and order all kinds of books, new and secondhand, or you can visit them. Have yourself a day out in Tunbridge. And if you do, the old fire station is just around the corner from the bookshop. So it's a good place to take your book and order some nice food and great coffee. So Ideas in Writing is going to be an occasional series. We've got to work out the logistics of interviews and conversations that we can have with people who are involved in writing, creativity, in the theatre, in publishing, in fiction, all kinds of fields. So who knows how often we'll make these, but we're starting off by uploading onto SoundCloud and the website some of the events we've had at the fire station. So we start off with a conversation with the phenomenally successful James Graham, in conversation with the actor and producer Jack Holden, who also happens to be my son. So in this hour or so, recorded in front of an audience at the old fire station in way back in October 2017, James talks about his influences, his interest in politics, how he researches and writes, and about making Rupert Murdoch a sympathetic character. He answers a few questions from the audience too, and talks about Ink, the play that that Jack was in at the time, This House, Labour of Love, Quiz. And of course, this was recorded before they shot Brexit, The Uncivil War, which you may have seen with Benedict Cumberbatch. So, apologise, the sound isn't the very best here, but, you know, we were just starting out recording these things. We've done our best to clean it up, and as we go on, I'm hoping the quality will get a little better. Okay, so thanks for listening, and I'll say a little bit more about Mr. Books and what we're going to do in the future at the end of this. So here's James Graham and Jack Holden.
Hi everyone, thanks very much for coming. This is James, James Graham, and I'm Jack Holden, Master Books, one of the Master Books, and I'm in Ink, which is not even James's latest play. It's a play that's come on since then. It's a play that's about to go on quite soon in Chichester. This man is prolific in his field. And I feel very lucky that I've managed to persuade him down here to my hometown to to climb inside his mind with you all. So I'll give you a little bit of background on James. This is thoroughly researched from Wikipedia. James Graham was raised in the Nottinghamshire village of Annesley, although, as we established, Annesley is so small that he changes, actually, the village he comes from, depending on which interviewer he's talking to. So, Annesley. He went to the Ashfield Comprehensive School and then studied at Hull University. His first play, Albert's Boy, was staged at the Finborough Theatre in West London in 2005. His next three plays, Eden's Empire, Little Madam, and Sons of York, also premiered at the Finborough, where he had become writer-in-residence. Tory Boys came next at the Soho Theatre, followed by Sudden Loss of Dignity.com at the Bush. We're going to talk about that one later, I think. Next up was A History of Falling Things at Theatre Clwyd. The Whiskey Taster back at the Bush. The Man at the Finborough. Bassett for NT Connections. And 66 Books at the Bush. Then finally, we get to the big stuff. This House. James's riotously funny play set in Labour and Tory whips offices between 1974 and 1979. Premiered at the National Theatre's Cottesloe in 2012, before moving to the Olivier, and then to the West End's Garrick Theatre. This House was nominated for Best New Play in both the Evening Standard Awards and the Olivier Awards. Meanwhile, James was busy penning Privacy, the Donnell, The Angry Brigade for Theatre Royal Plymouth, and the book for the stage version of Finding Neverland with songs by all of our favourite, Gary Barlow. And we're only in 2014. In 2015, James's play The Vote, dramatising the quintessentially British experience of the polling station, was performed at the Donmar on election night and beamed live to homes across the country, finishing just as real polling stations closed. Monster Raving Loony premiered at Plymouth in 2016, which brings us to this year. Ink, the play I'm in, premiered at the Almeida and is now at the Duke of York's Theatre. Labour of Love is literally a few doors down at the Noel Coward Theatre. And Quiz, the story of the infamous Who Wants to Be a Millionaire cheater, or not, Major Charles Ingram, opens soon in Chichester. And now I need to lie down. I'm insane. And I haven't even mentioned James's work on television. Coalition for Channel 4, and his recently announced film for BBC Films, Gypsy Boy, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. you've got a good audience. James won't mind me telling you, because I cleared it with him earlier, that he's 35. He's only 35 years old. His CV is incredible for someone so young, and to boot, he's one of the nicest people in theatre. With so much already achieved, including this visit to Tunbridge, I mean, I'm sort of a pinnacle of it. I think it's time we ask, in James' own words, referenced in Ink, the five W's: who, what, where, when, and why. So, we'll start with number one. Who? James, I've just read the Wikipedia entry about you. But who is James Graham?
Good start, easy. I don't know. I mean, what do you literally want me to say to that?
I feel like James Graham now is a name. It's like it's like a play by James Graham is a big kind of, if you're a producer, that's something for your show. So I mean, tell us who the real you is. Like, tell us kind of, you know, tell us your sad dark secrets.
What keeps me awake at night? I just want to say thank you, obviously, for coming to this. I feel very flattered that people wanted to turn up, and I think it's amazing that Helen and the family are doing this, and I wish them well. I didn't really, like lots of people, I didn't really have a huge amount of necessarily theatre in my life when I grew up. I was lucky enough to have parents that encouraged my creativity from a young age. They gave me a typewriter when I was 3 years old, and I would churn out really bad short stories and make my family read them, and I would, I think my access point to drama, to art, was always television and drama, which is why it's something that's something I really want to pursue. But I grew up in a mining town when dramas like Alvina's Own Pet and Boys in the Black stuff and older stuff like Kraken, the Granada Studios things, they just really captivated me. I don't have no idea why. And I guess if I was going to psychoanalyze myself, I was definitely an introverted, kind of shy kid, and I found a lot of safety in spending time in my own head and imagining and projecting scenarios and exchanges with fictional characters as a way of, I think, dealing with some of the things I either found fun or I found difficult. And it's a strange, being a playwright in particular, is a strange mix of public and private. You have to spend an incredible amount of time on your own. And then without a moment's notice, you suddenly have to be very public, like this. And there are moments when, there are joyful moments, actually. I really like it when you might not write, you might not see anyone or speak to anyone for days, and then someone will call you and you go to speak and your voice doesn't come out. Because you realise, oh God, I haven't actually said anything for a couple of days. So it's a discombobulating mix, but it's one that I enjoy. I enjoy, and that's also the joy of being a playwright. You can be a screenwriter and a novelist and a TV writer and maintain a level of privacy in your works. It's quite an isolating process, including a film, which we can talk about later if you're interested. But when you're writing a play, you have to be thrust into a room for 4 or 5 weeks with a company of actors like yourself. And you have to batter into shape and wield your beast. It's a very public collaboration.
That's the play, not the actors.
Sometimes, as you know, sometimes the actors as well. But it's, so I enjoy that. And without theatre, I imagine I'd be a much. I would have fallen back on what I think is my factory setting, which is to be quite private.
And in Annesley or wherever you choose to come from, and your high school, I mean, what was your provision for drama like when you were at school?
I was furiously lucky. So it was the biggest comprehensive school in the country in terms of overpopulation in a very industrial, rundown part of Nottinghamshire during a very difficult time. But I was so privileged. I was so privileged because I had a drama teacher who just believed that kids from these kinds of families should do plays and should be given texts and be thrown into school shows. So I had a drama teacher, Mr. Humphreys, who forced me onto the stage, Mrs. Robinson, and it unlocked something. I felt very safe there and I loved it. So it was a rough, tough school, but I wouldn't have changed a single thing. I was very, very lucky.
And that brings me to what drew you to writing for the stage? I mean, was it that those teachers pushed you onto the stage, like you said, and you said you've been writing from a very young age, so when did you start, you know, making characters speak? And
I always did, because I didn't really have theatre, I always wrote from about 3 or 4 years old, but it was mainly prose novels. But when I discovered school plays, I started to try and write scripts and texts. But the first time I showed anyone I wrote was probably at university, when I was about 18, 19. The joy of going to university and doing drama, that was the first time I finally go to university, and the joy of doing drama is that you get to pick your niche. You could be a director or an actor or a lighting designer, you could build sets, you could do radio. So the writing thing, again, it's that mix of public, private. I didn't really feel confident going on stage too much, but I felt confident in my room typing out something and then giving that someone else to do.
And when was the last time you acted?
I'm acting now. I did a monologue in a London theatre about 7 years ago, which then took on tour. I don't know. I'm going to ask you some questions, but I think it's different if you're in a big company show. This was a monologue, and there's not a huge amount I enjoyed about being in Grimsby, no disrespect to Grimsby, but on a Saturday night on your own in your dressing room, waiting to go on stage. And I really felt that feeling of being on stage and feeling incredibly lonely on stage, even though you've got 200 people looking at you, and not loving that too much. So I haven't massively pursued it since.
That brings me to our third W, where. Where do you write? Like, physically, what is your setup?
Right at home, I live in London, I live in Kennington, which we were discussing earlier is where all the MPs live, so I know it. It's a very niche hobby, but I get to spot them going to my local shop. So I have a little place there, and I write from home, but you can't always dictate where you can write, because if you are, especially if you're doing play, and there was a crossover point at some point last month when I was doing it, where I was in rehearsals for three different shows. So you can't always dictate your own day or where you're going to write. So sometimes you find yourself with 12 minutes here, and that probably sounds very an industrial way to make work, rather than it being walking on the Lake District and using. But sometimes you just have to, if you find a moment, and you just quickly throw some stuff down. So often anywhere, but I need to be on my own really, and somewhere quiet, and not really music, not really anything, just.
I think I interrupted quite a lot of your writing at the Almeida because we were having to, well, James was having to produce new scenes on a daily basis at one point because some of the elements weren't quite slotting together. James would go up to the green room at the Almeida Theatre to sort of try and write, and I'd sit next to him and sort of chat to him, and then he'd be really short with me, and I'd be like, why is he... That's rude, isn't it? Yeah, he's writing the play, and I'm supposed to do in a few weeks. I'll probably leave him to it.
You literally had nothing to say that afternoon, and they had to generate the content
to
say.
And so where do you... I suppose, you know, you're carving out... name and a career as Britain's foremost political playwright, but you didn't start writing about the Whip's offices. So where do you draw your inspiration from? Is it just the politicians you see walking around in Kennington? Or?
No. It's more history than politics often. I know there are people. Maybe people here who write and consider themselves political writers, and I think there is a difference between political theatre and theatre about politics. And I probably more comfortably sit in the second one. I enjoy writing about the process and the systems that govern us in the institutions that govern us and that have power, whether it be tabloid newspapers or polling stations or Labour MPs' offices in the Midlands. But that isn't necessarily political theatre. There are people who would argue that because it isn't outwardly trying to achieve anything, it's not. I wouldn't call myself an activist playwright. I don't expect people to leave my shows and join the barricades. I wouldn't mind, but I don't say it's not the reason why I'm doing it. So discussed whether I'm a political playwright or not. But I know I write about politics. But I just loved history. It was really history that was my access point to all politics. Until I did history A-level at school, I'd never heard terms like Marxism or socialism. I learned those terms by looking at the past and their context within a narrative. And the joy of history to me is it is narrative, it's plot. A character makes a decision based on baggage. There is a consequence to that decision, cause and effect, and the world shifts. And that's just a gift. And I've always, I didn't invent it. Shakespeare did it, the Greeks did it. And then I think I'm third. But it's, you know, if you want to make sense of your world now, you go back to the past. And the reason often why Shakespeare did that, because he wanted to get his head chopped off. So instead of talking about Elizabeth II, he talked about Richard III. That was always a no-brainer to me to make sense of the now by going back to the past, which is, I just think, by default, make it inherently political.
Yeah. The next W is when. And I thought the best when for this would be, when are you going to take a break? I remember, I think when we met up one time last year, I think you sort of implied that you hadn't slept in your own flat for like months because you'd been off, maybe this is the year before, maybe you'd been to America and you were sort of, you were very rarely at home.
Yeah.
So when do you schedule free time? What do you do? I mean, do you want to stop for a bit or, you know?
I do and I don't. I have good people around me who, that sounds quite infantilizing, but I need help sometimes to get dragged away from my work. That's something I'm conscious of. And also, if you're not living your life and you're not exposed to the work, then you've got nothing to write about. So weirdly, I can justify taking time off. If in my head I think this is going to really help my but no, I do. Yeah, it's not the thing I've nailed completely in terms of that balance. But that's a process.
Yeah, I feel a bit bad for asking that question because I feel like that's what a lot of journalism is trying to sort of get out of you at the moment. It's almost like some press sort of resents your success and youth and wants to sort of work out when it's all going to fall apart. Do you feel that?
I think they definitely want to build the character of the tortured playwright is good and fair. I'm not saying I'm not occasionally tortured, but yeah, I think I just really enjoy what I'm doing, and also I suppose I feel not a responsibility, but as someone who enjoys writing the kinds of plays I like writing, and feel very lucky at the moment to be able to put that into a West End theatre, and then people come, the Chancellor of the Exchequer comes, and the leader of the Labour Party will come, and you only have a very brief window of opportunity, I think, to talk about the things that matter to you, to an audience that actually can affect and make a difference. So it's hard sometimes to go to Centre Parks for a week when you think the window of time for you to do that is narrowing.
Yes. Could you write a play about Centre Parks?
There is a great play about Centre Parks somewhere. I don't think it's me.
You've got to be true to you. And the last W I have is why. In Ink, you write that our main character, Larry Lamb, asking Rupert Murdoch, what is it? What does Rupert Murdoch want? Which I always understand as you, as us, as all of us, sort of asking what makes Rupert Murdoch tick? Why does he do what he does? So not to sort of equalise you with Rupert Murdoch. As a playwright, do you think it's your job to ask the why or to answer the why?
Only ever to ask. Oh, is that true? No, I think you can make offers and suggestions about why things are the way they are, why so for example in this house when I play at the National about the 1970s on Parliament, I think you can ask questions about why this very old system with its very strange rituals sometimes doesn't allow people to be the best versions of themselves in a system that demands people to be the best version of themselves without pinning it down, without nailing it.
Yeah.
And I never for a second intended Ink to answer the question, why does Rupert Murdoch today do what Rupert Murdoch does? But you can, there are clearly little windows into what I think and what I believe, but not that are oppressive and not that would deny you the chance to go away from the play with your own version of it.
Mm.
I think any theatre, any plays, any films that answers the questions comprehensively that they ask are dramatically dead, and I think you have to have a nuance there, an ambiguity that leaves the audience going away intrigued to continue that journey once the lights go down.
So this sort of chimes with what you were saying earlier, that you don't write your plays as a piece of activism, you write them more as a sort of, I mean, there is a nudge in your plays, isn't there? I mean, you don't write them completely on the fence. I feel like there's some kind of nudge in there.
I reject this idea, not that anyone's really attacked me for it, but I know that I'd probably consider it to be, if playwrights were on a spectrum of Labour and it's Corbyn and it's Blair, I would be the third way candidate.
You heard it here first.
I definitely don't want that. But I can see why people would think that my compromise or my tolerance for dissenting opinions means that the plays themselves are toothless or that they lack a provocation of an argument. And I suppose, regardless of the quality of them, which can be debated, I reject that idea. I reject that me giving airtime to Rupert Murdoch for him to explain why he does what he does and why he believes what he believes is not me sitting on the fence. You give characters these viewpoints in the way that the Labour play that just opened. Different characters express different deeply felt opinions about where they sit on the wing of the Labour Party. And I think it would be possible just about to leave that plane not knowing which one of those is mine, and I don't mind that for a second.
Mm. There was quite a few people we heard leaving the Almeida Theatre, having watched Ink, really wanted the play to be a hatchet job. They really wanted you to go for Murdoch. why didn't you?
lawyers. because then you're no better than him, because that's what he does in his newspapers, and it's black and white or red, and there's no... Ultimately, I find it less entertaining and dramatic, so that's the first, for me, with any play, any piece of art, that's the first port of call. How dramatic is it? How entertaining it is, which I feel like that's a word we're not meant to use in serious playwriting circles, entertaining, which people equate entertaining with trousers falling down and custard pies, but it's not. It's about story and emotional depth and richness. But also it's what people expect. It's at the Almeida Theatre in Islington. It's in Corbyn's constituency, and everyone buys the Guardian. So if they come here and you just give them what they want, it's just there's no fizz in the room. Mm-hmm. But to watch them as you don't know this because you're backstage. But to watch, it was always my dark desire and the director's desire to have people walk out in the interval. no, so I don't mean that, but...
finish the sentence.
What the heck?
To go to the bar in the interval and be racked with sudden Guardian guilt that they actually quite like Murdoch and they want him to succeed. And if I could briefly achieve that, and then of course I think in the second act we hold him more to account and the consequences of his beliefs. And you know, there might be people here who know our Murdoch fans, and that's totally fine as well, because what I think is also important is that you don't just want people to come who agree with you. You want, otherwise nothing changes, and it's just a room of people sat there going, oh yes, my prejudice has been confirmed, then theatre really is pointless and dead. So I do want, very cynically, the Daily Mail to give an okay review and the Sun to give an okay review, and they did. And so what you have, therefore, is people who read those papers come and having a conversation with you in the work, which for me is much more important than a badge of honour that got all the News International plays to hate us. There's no satisfaction for me in that.
Yeah, and you sell more tickets.
that's a bonus, but it's not.
So I wanted to talk to you about, what's the play? Ink. We're doing Ink. Ink started at the Almeida and then moved into town, which is, the Almeida at the moment is becoming this big sort of funnel for West End plays. That's quite a traditional way of doing things, as is putting a play on in a regional theatre, a fringe theatre, and then it coming into town. But Labour of Love has gone straight in at the West End, which is fantastic for the West End and for new writing and plays. So I just wanted your kind of take on the state of the West End and new writing at the moment.
I think it's in a great place, and obviously there is a theatre ecology beyond the West End. Including Tunbridge, and from where I'm from. But for whatever reason, better or worse, there is an epicentre where, generally speaking, most writers gather and give their work, and then hopefully you hope it goes out from there. So, yes, it goes in cycles, but there are frequent... I remember 7 years ago, there was a dearth of new plays in the West End, and people bemoaned it, and thanks to a lot of support from various different producers, that's changing. So as a producer, the first rule of producing theatre is you do not open a play straight into the West End. There's only been a couple this decade, and less than eight since the turn of the century. Probably less than that, actually. So that was my commission, that was the challenge that the producer, Michael Grandage, who is a director and he's currently directing Frozen on Broadway, so I think it'll be fine for the future. But it's still a financial
risk. Frozen the musical?
Yeah.
Cool.
I've been talking for 20 minutes and that's what's
sorry,
cool.
Sorry.
But it's still a risk to do a commercial play about the Labour Party, but that was the proposition to me. You do a piece of political theatre that says something about the world, but that can gather a mainstream audience, and that being its DNA. So I said, sure, I'll try. And then that took over a few years. And the Labour Party kept changing, which is its want to do. But we committed to putting it straight into the Noel Coward Theatre this autumn. And yes, so we're the first place to do that. Heisenberg pretends it is, but that Broadway first. So we are the first in many years. And it was all going brilliantly. We had a cast. I'd written the play, I'd finished the play, and then two things happened. Theresa May called an election, and no one ever thinks about the playwrights when that happens. It's really annoying. And Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party did best than people thought. They went up, and the Tory Party went down, and that was not the narrative that had been happening. Well, actually, because the Labour Party had not gained seats since 97,
yeah.
Their literal seats, so they'd been going down, and there had been no swing of that scale of the Labour Party since 1945. So the questions the play was asking were fundamentally different about the nature of the Labour Party. Brutally, I'd expect the play to be an autopsy of a party that was collapsing.
Mm.
Regardless of what I think about the direction of travel, that felt like what the play was going to be. So Corbyn ruined that, and I had to shift it. And that was really hard because it wasn't like changing the end; it wasn't like changing the last bit or certain lines. It was in you sort of when you start a play, you ask all these questions. Imagine it's like building a skyscraper, and you lay all these foundations, and you build this huge thing, and you're just about to put the flag at the top, and something changes, and you can't just change the top floors. So you have to go all the way down to the foundations again without the thing coming down. It's the very pretentious way I would describe it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go away and really microcosmically alter it. The second thing that happened was that we had cast Sarah Lancashire in the part, who was obviously a gorgeous, wonderful national treasure, but unfortunately she couldn't do it due to illness 2 weeks into the rehearsal. So I'd already, that weekend, I'd let it go. By Sunday night, I decided it wasn't going to happen, and I'd emotionally let it go. Because you cannot open a commercial play like that in the West End without the guarantee of filling 900 seats a night, 8 times a week. You can't do it. So they went away to try and find someone who could do that, and it sounds very cynical, but you want people to come and see your work, and they will do that mainly often through the actors. So we found someone. We were very lucky. The Monday morning, Tamsin Gregson up in the rehearsal room, and she agreed to do it, and she is so gorgeous in the play that the reviews are so good that I think people are coming and we're now selling out, so that was a relief. But whatever your question was,
I've forgotten as well.
The Theatre College in the West End is in great shape. We do more plays than there have been for a generation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with Labour of Love, you had everything thrown at you to make it not work. But I actually couldn't think of a better last minute replacement than Tamsin Gregg. She's almost it's sort of a miracle that she was available and ready to do it as well. Because
do you know what? She was at Centre Parks.
I think that's
why it's in my head. But she was at Centre Parks with her kids and she said, I'm not reading this in the Centre Parks. But she read it in her cabin or whatever, and she came home. Yeah, that was very lucky.
Ruined her holiday, but I'm sure she's getting paid quite well. I think would you say it's fair to say that is an example of how sometimes in this industry stars just have to really align for you because it's a hard industry and things a lot of things don't want to work in your direction, but
yeah, I mean, it's always easier to not do plays than do them, and it's always easier to fail than to succeed. And I'm not taking any personal credit for this, but what's exciting, I think, at the moment is there is a body of work of new writing in the West End and around the country that is politically motivated, that's socially engaged. Given what's happening in the world, I guess there's almost no excuse not to be, but it's not. Actually, I love farces. I think Lord's Love is one of the greatest plays ever written, but it's not running around chasing girls. It's asking big questions about who we are and where we're going and what we can maybe do as a people to improve things, whilst being entertaining and theatrical and getting an audience. So I think we're in really good shape at the moment.
Mm. I want to talk about a couple of projects you've got coming up. So, quiz,
yep.
Which is about the infamous Who Wants to Be a Millionaire cheaters, or did they cheat? Opens in Chichester.
In 2 weeks, yeah.
That's quite a departure from media moguls or political figures. What drew you to that?
Because it didn't feel like a departure, actually. It felt like one of the things to channel my inner David Ayer. You want to sort of pick off, you want to start ticking off all the institutions, and weirdly, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was an institution in this country, and obviously that represents media and entertainment. But then there's also the courts, the judiciary, and what I discovered by reading a book that was just about to get published by a journalist from The Guardian. Anyway, he's a guy called Bob Wolfenden, who's a great journalist. He has since I started published a book which examines, do you remember what we're talking about? The coffin major, who actually, what's weird about that is that he never coughed once, but he's the coffin major.
He's
but someone that
accomplices coughed.
Accomplices coughed.
I don't know, guilty.
That was in 2001, if you can believe that, 16 years ago. And it was, even though it represents probably quite a silly little trial of reasonably mockable figures in what feels like a reasonably stupid crime, I think, obviously, it represents something fundamentally, a shift in how our institutions present truth. Oh God, this game of pretentious for Sunday night. But basically, what people forget is that he went on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire on the 10th of July 2001, and the day after that, with the planes at the Twin Towers. So that his news story got cancelled because of that. And without either offensively or crudely making comparisons with that event and the other one, I think what happened in 2001, with the Hutton Inquiry and the David Kelly suicide, and the way that governments can sex up a dossier, or that newspapers can turn on people, citizens, and hop, drag them before the stocks, represents the beginning of a shift which we're now dealing with quite a lot in autumn, whether it's how many people go to an inauguration, or was it 350 million, or was it not, on the side of the bus? It's something, I know media outlets and politicians have always lied, but it's this Adam Curtis-like thing of what is this lying and this truth, that is when the realities merge, and national narratives merge, and you don't ever know really what reality you're living in anymore. I say all that like it's really grand. I mean, Chris Tower's a character in play, so it's not it's hugely grand. But I enjoyed the challenge or the prospect, I guess, of doing a play about people who cheated on a game show, to use that to ask questions about objective truth, right or wrong. Is there can you get the right answer and the wrong answer anymore when you're talking about inauguration crowds or how much it costs to be in the EU?
Mm. And you have written a piece for Hull.
Have not laid it. It opens in 2 months. So
you haven't written it?
No, not yet.
Okay. Great. Can we call it a night there?
That was always the plan. It's for the City of Culture, and we are, which has been transformed. We talk a lot about London, but it's been so transformative. This City of Culture in Hull. I was there this morning, and it's changed that city in all the ways that art, you hope, can, not just creatively, but in terms of well-being, literal health statistics, physiologically, the health of assistance change is amazing. So we thought it would be fun to, at the end of every city, well, there's only the second UK City of Culture, and they're going to announce the next one this year. They have to account for how successful it was to the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, and to the Arts Council. So I was working with, I spent all my time up there this year meeting the producers and knowing. It began, I must say, by the producers saying, do you want to write a play for us to end the year? And I said, yes, but can it be about you? Can I take the piss out of you? And they said, yeah. So in like a W1A 2012, they said, yeah, come in. And so they let me like go into all their secret meetings so that I can satirise them at the end of the year, including the city council and all the different partners and bodies. So that's what it's meant to be. But what really excited me, being a geek, was that I met these the data analytics team in the organised office, and their job is audience measurement, how you measure the impact of a work of art, whether it's a show at Orchard Theatre or one of the things that people really loved was they put a blade, like a turbine blade, in the middle of the square, which was made by Siemens, which is a factory coming to Hull, not necessarily because of it being the city of culture. And they tried to measure how well the blade was changing people's lives, how many people were looking at it. If you're walking to farm foods and you stop and you do that, and then you carry on, is that engagement? So little things, so they would put cameras, and if you like look at it, they can recognise where your eyes are looking in the square. And if you look at it for a second, if you smile a bit, then that's the word. So, but all the way, like how you measure art and the usefulness of culture and the art, I found so brilliantly bureaucratic, and how you smash the words of science and maths with art. And you go to these meetings where Burnley, Labour, Hull, City Council is going, so you know that Bally thing that came up here? They're desperately trying to say, how much has that benefited our city? And so someone produces a pie chart of well-being, and everyone's looking at it really hard. But I think there's potential for comedy there. But also hopefully something really moving about loads of people trying to desperately understand, does culture make a difference? Mm-hmm. And obviously I think it does. But that's going to be the farce.
Mm-hmm. Well, data and analytics is quite an interest of yours, because in privacy, there were whole sections of the show where you actually asked the audience to get their phones out and go through some processes that would show us how much companies like Google and Apple store information about us and use it. And I've been quite glib about this in the past, and you've actually got quite angry with me about being glib about it, because I sort of say I don't mind them having my data because it means they can furnish me with sort of great adverts and stuff. Yeah. But I mean, tell us more about that. Was it on privacy that you entered this world?
It completely radicalised me in that one particular area. George Orwell's first, and I'm second. To continue that stupid joke, but there are... I think it's the biggest crisis facing all of us. I know no one else believes that, and that's totally fine. But I'm not a troglodyte. I think that technology, generally speaking, can only improve our lives and our well-being and our societies. But I spent so much time in Silicon Valley with people in Google and Facebook, and academics and psychologists, actually, and sociologists. And we are in this unforgivable Wild West period where it would be the equivalent of you invent the car and put cars on the road, and eventually someone says, you know what, we should really paint and wipe that line down the middle because this is insane. And then put seatbelts in. But no one's doing that. In a way, it's not the security and the civil liberties angles that really worries me, because I know there's always going to be a balance and we'll constantly recalibrate that. What worries me is, for example, I went to Facebook in Silicon Valley and worked with actually Mark Zuckerberg's sister, Randy Zuckerberg, who was this brilliant, she's the marketing director. And we talked her through some stuff we'd found that she didn't really go against, which was some Cambridge scientists had discovered 4 years ago, that if you you can use your Facebook profile to work out things such as your religion, your sexuality, your emotional state, your mental health. So for example now, and then I'll stop talking about this because I know it's really boring, but loss of privacy on one level, we still think of it as being you know what book I bought from Amazon, and that feels weird. It goes beyond that to, it's not just, for example, when you, if you were a gay 14-year-old, and you came out to your parents, that they would know that. It's that I swear to God, it's now possible, it's been proven to about an 80% hit rate, that through your Facebook likes, the Facebook algorithm can learn your sexuality before you even know it. And it's getting younger and younger to about 12, 11, 10. So that's the breach of privacy, where they know you before you know. Again, does it matter? It does with political parties. So Ted Cruz, a presidential campaign, were the first people to use this. So you might think that you are not afraid of immigration, or that you are not scared of ISIS, but thousands and thousands of data points, including where you are, what you read, the questions you ask Google at night, the way you type, the speed you type at when you're anxious, they know that, for example, that maybe you are a bit afraid of it. and so they will tailor the political ads to you. And Ted Cruz had like thousands of variants on the same political ad, where they would change the colour, the music, and you would get your individual political ad. I think that is beyond terrifying. And some people might argue that that's just what people have always been doing for years. I'm a political party, I want to try and convince you that my government is the best, so I'm going to poll you and try and come up with a way of selling to you. But when you don't realise that that's what they're doing, and when it is possible, possibly, that they know you better than you know yourself. Not they, there's no person reading it, it's just the algorithm, it's just the software. Mm. And no one built it to do this, it wasn't meant to do this. Mark Zuckerberg is just as scared about this as anyone. We did this play in New York, and Daniel Radcliffe played like a weird version of me, which my mum was thrilled about. But he played a writer character meeting all these people. And Eric Schmidt, who is the CEO of Google, came and watched it and sort of said, it terrifies him. It really terrifies him, the AI, artificial intelligence, and how the software they built, they've not lost control of it, but it's started to learn at such an exponential rate they no longer know what it's learning about us. Is interesting. Thank you for letting me rant about that.
I think it's one of the best rants you've got, actually.
It kills any party I'm at. Take your phone out, I'll show you really good.
Well, let's not kill the party. Let's open up to questions from the floor. We've covered a lot, but if anybody has any questions they'd like to pose to James, please raise your hand. Yes.
Could you talk about Larry Lamb in the ink? I don't know how many people have already seen it, but I was very lucky, I saw it last week.
Sure.
And I thought the play, although everyone's talking about it being about Murdoch, and actually I do have a friend who said she felt uneasy because she felt like she was cheering for Murdoch. She's very young. But when I saw it, I thought the character of Larry Lamb was interesting. When you said about learning from history, I felt like he was trying to recreate history. He was trying to get back to being a newspaperman and he didn't know he was getting away from it. But I thought it was interesting to be the way
you talked about the film. Cool. Thank you for that. I should also mention that on that list of Wikipedia entries that there's a play which was produced, which was called Hook, and there's a missing entry there, so you can...
Ooh.
That's not your fault, that's Wikipedia's fault. Wikipedia's fault. So Ink, I enjoyed the idea, I suppose, that if you're going to do a play about the Sun's formation in 1969, that Murdoch wouldn't be the main protagonist, it would be the antagonist. And that you would actually see it through the prism of someone who goes on a much bigger journey. So the main character in Ink, starring Jack Holden, went until January the 6th. it's really a guy called Larry Lamb, played by a great actor called Richard Coyle. He wouldn't recognise from great TV drama. Larry Lamb was an editor who felt like he should one day edit the Mirror. He'd been snubbed and he'd been sent up to Manchester to do the Northern editor of the Daily Mail. He has a scar on his forehead for reasons which we don't reveal at the very end of the play, but there's myths that go around Fleet Street about where this scar came from, and he's this really brutal, smoking northerner. So he feels like he's in Sopranos or something, and he's been outcast from the Fleet Street world, and Murdoch is looking for an editor for the New Sun. The Sun was bought from the Daily Mirror in 1969. It used to be a very high-class quality broadsheet newspaper. And they were selling it, and Murdoch wanted to buy it and do something different with it. And he found Larry Lamb, who was feeling bruised and angry, and in the same way that Murdoch was feeling bruised and angry. It's hard to imagine now, but at the time, Murdoch, possibly self-styled, but saw himself as an outsider. He couldn't get into the establishment. The press barons that run Fleet Street were these old dynasties, families, Beaverbrook and beyond, and he couldn't find his way through, and everyone mocked him. They mocked him all through his Oxford University days for being the Australian sheep farmer, and he was angry. The fact that he came from huge privilege and money and wealth is something he leaves out of that story, but he was angry, and he found someone else who was angry, and they decided to change things, almost Heath Ledger style in Batman. They wanted to burn it down and start again. And Fleet Street, at the time, as you all probably know, was an entirely self-contained world of every newspaper house was there. And the unions were geographically based there, and that's where they got their power from as well. So Larry Lamb just felt like the more interesting character in a way, because Murdoch stays relatively consistent in his ideology of introducing free market ideas into news, and it not being a plaything for rich people. competition and sales figures and all these sacrilegious things at the time. And he found in Larry Lamb a populist who wanted to reach as many people as possible. So I hope the moral journey of the play is that at the very beginning of it, you recognise at its heart the value of that project, which was that there were sections of the country that felt like they were being ignored, including where Larry Lamb came from, a Yorkshire mining town, where they were sick of being lectured and preached to by a very narrow political establishment. So they set about a project of giving people what they want, which started off quite well, but then of course the natural end point of that is that we're all flawed and we're all weak, and sometimes what we want isn't what's best for us or anyone else. So in the course of 1 year, remarkably, it just covers 1 year of the first life of the Sun newspaper, as they fought to beat the Mirror to become the biggest selling paper in the world. It ends with the first page to be on the exact anniversary of the... I've ruined it, haven't I, if you come and see it.
completely
it's history, so it exists, it's not spoilers, but on the anniversary of that deadline that Murdoch gave Larry Lamb, sort of, to beat the Mirror, he came up with this idea of the page to be and they found a girl, so I met the original girl. He's still alive, and that then evolved into something else, and things started to change.
I think it's obvious if you see or read the play that it's kind of got this Faustian element to it, and in that world, Larry Lamb is very much a Faust character, and
yeah,
that makes Rupert Murdoch the devil.
It does. Except what was always fun to me was all my metaphors of Star Wars recently, which may alienate some of you, but in the prequels, the terrible prequels to Star Wars, the joy is that you know eventually that someone's that the kid's going to become Darth Vader. The joy with Murdoch is that you think he already is Darth Vader when you meet him in the play, but then Murdoch has all these huge moral wobbles, and then I think that's true to real life. Something happened, which I won't spoil. But a shocking personal event happened to Rupert Murdoch in the first 3 weeks of the newspaper's existence, and it involves death and blood and a threat to his and his family's life, and the cost of life actually in his family. And he was faced with this dilemma of whether or not this new newspaper, which should report on anything and not be reverential to society, should report on it, and he, in real life, he really struggled with that because he created this beast, and then something happened to him, and the beast went, you've got to apply this same system to you, and he struggled with that, and I think in that brief flicker, I think an audience can feel real empathy for him, and it's Larry Lamb who, having learnt from his master, is going like, no, we're going to do this, and something horrible happens as a result of that, and you leave the play having, I hope, been surprised at what you were actually watching all along was not Murdoch teach Larry Lamb to be him, but actually it was Larry Lamb that taught Murdoch how to be Murdoch. And as he walks out the play, you feel like you've just seen him, but he's gone. And that's, I think, with a few little tweaks, that's just history. That's
origin
just history.
Story.
There's no origin.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Any other questions? Yes.
When you first started talking, you were talking about liking being in your quiet room and not speaking to lots of people for days and that sort of thing. And I'm interested in novels and playwriting, and that's what a novelist does as well.
Of course.
And that's what a playwright does. So what made you decide that you have, because good novels, I would argue, do that, telling people what you think or not what you think, or lead them down pathways and make them react and not react, in the sort of same way that plays do, except plays, it seems to me, involve working with people to put your ideas across and somehow kind of platting your story. And I just wondered what made you make the decision not to, to leave your awful short stories, I'm sure you'll find, but your short stories in your little room and everything, and decide to go into the theatre and be a much more kind of collaborative person?
I think, I think that's a good question, and I don't necessarily, I'm not conscious of the time I made that decision, except the first time I did it, I felt really safe in a room of people collaborating with me, as opposed to in some way I think I would almost feel more unsafe or unsure if I was on my own and in my own head, because you never get challenged. And I think it's fair to say that the process of Ink was an extreme version of that, and bless Jack and the rest of the company for doing it. But you always make, whenever you go to the first day of a read through of a new play in a rehearsal room and you meet all your actors, and in Ink's case there's 14, 13, and it's people you know and recognise and revere, and they've said they'll yes to your play, and you've got the director and the creative team there. And my thing, I'm aware of doing that, you walk around first day going hello, hello, hello. And I always find myself saying, oh God, this first day is the worst, isn't it? So nervous. I feel so exposed and vulnerable. But actually, secretly, I'm often quite excited. I'm really excited to hear the work. So that came back to bite me in the arse with Ink, because I felt that first reading, I felt so exposed, particularly in the second act, because it didn't feel like it was working. And it's the worst feeling in the world to spend like a year and a half or something and walk confidently up to a table and go, guys, you're going to spend the rest of 2017 with me and we're going to do this play. And I'm sure no one, I'd be interested to know what you think, but I felt throughout the course of the play I started to really go grey, and I just felt each individual moment was, I thought, fine. But for some reason it wasn't pulling together as a greater sum of its parts. And I'd fallen horrifically into the trap I always tried to stop myself falling into, which was just assuming that putting lots of exciting events one after the other would be fine, but it was just episodic and it didn't amount to anything. It didn't say anything, and I felt embarrassed. And I felt apologetic, and I remember. So I basically left the room for about a week.
I think that was. I feel like I remember you leaving the read through with a lot of notes.
Yeah.
And you left with sort of your head hanging, and I think we all felt quite bad about that, because all we'd done was sort of read your play. And then the director had said, give us sort of three things you like and three things you don't like. And the three things we liked were like, that's a funny line, that's a cool character, we like that bit. And the three things we didn't like were like, where's the structure of the second story? That doesn't make sense. Why are we doing this play? Yeah. Which is,
And also you have to do that. I mean, there's nothing you did wrong, because you have to sit there and you have to take that, because it was the things that I was feeling anyway. But you have to. I just don't know. I wouldn't change it for a second because I don't know any other way to work. And I imagine if you're writing a novel, it's already published on the shelves, and then you find out what people think. Why wouldn't you adapt and change constantly? So that was the most furious rewriting process I've ever been on. It never stopped all the way through to the first preview and then beyond. So with theatre, you get normally like a week, if you're lucky, 6-7 previews before the critics come in. And on preview 3, preview 4, I was still bringing in pages at 12 o'clock that they would have to learn and put in that night. And your opportunity is shrinking. And it's terrifying for you guys because you never get to nail it down, you never get to feel safe and settle it and start doing your job. So there is a point when you just have to let it go so that you can do your job. But I wouldn't change it. If you can tolerate all the things that don't matter, how it makes you feel about yourself, and just go, how can I use this to make the best piece of art possible? Then it should be great. How was it for you?
Really fun. It was the second proper new play I worked on. The other was a play called Oppenheimer. It was about J. Robert Oppenheimer, who invented the atomic bomb. So it was kind of similar sort of stories in a way, these kind of troubled geniuses making something bigger than they ever imagined. Was mass obliteration. and so I was sort of steeled for it, and my part is relatively small in the grand scheme of things, and I actually think I got a net gain over the rewrites. I think you gave me more lines, so I was really happy. Until, this is an interesting anecdote, I played the first page 3 photographer, who was a guy called Beverly Goodaway, if you can believe it, and he's now deceased, but one of his daughters came to watch in one of the early shows, and I was told she was watching, and so after the show, I bounded out of my dressing room to meet her, expecting her to be full of praise. She looked distraught, and she was just like, she said, "Daddy wasn't like that at all. He didn't have long hair, so we're very long wig. He didn't smoke, he didn't speak like that, and he never would have danced like you danced." And so then I realised that they were sort of expecting a different thing. They were expecting a lifelike representation of their father on stage, but that's not really the point of it, is it?
I mean, no, that happened to you before, but that never happened to me before. And that's really hard for you, and we're feeling a huge responsibility towards you. And I think we both said that's really hard for them. We both sort of acknowledged that, God, that must be so weird and strange to go and see someone you love on stage and not be the same thing. Having said that, then 2 days later, the other sister came. I'll do this because I was sat next to her, but she had I'm doing that, like staring at her. She had a great time, and she saw what the language of the style was, which is quite clearly not a naturalistic presentation. Mm. It's a theatrical representation. But it's, of course, and I deal mostly in real people, so I have to negotiate that all the time. With Quiz, the people who are accused of cheating, Charles and Diana Ingram, they came to the rehearsal room this week. And it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. But you of course, forget that they're scared more scared. It's like spiders. They're scared of you than you are of them. But I take that responsibility very seriously. You definitely don't go out of your way to misrepresent anyone, even, dare I say, Rupert Murdoch. I've got a responsibility to him to not falsely represent his views from my own political agenda.
Any more questions? Yes, sir.
So, rural Nottinghamshire.
Yes.
To trendy Kennington. How's it changed your views in relation to what you're going to produce in the future?
Ooh. I hope I've still got one foot in the Nottinghamshire village. And in fact, Labour of Love is a play based and set in my hometown in Nottinghamshire. And it gives me a weird thrill to hear those village names mentioned on the West End stage. One that's unpronounceable, but I actually come from a place called Nunkergate, which Tams and Greg and Marty Freeman did not believe was a real place. That's just a noise, but no, Nunkergate is where I'm from. and my family came down, and I know how thrilled they were to, especially this sounds overly political, but a lot of those towns, communities felt very ignored and voiceless during some of our recent history. And I think to give them a voice in the West End is important to me. So now, I mean, my family is still based there, my friends are still there. So I can absolutely, I think, go to the milk shop and see George Osborne buying his eggs.
In Kennington?
Yeah. Not in Nashville, no. Actually, no, George Osborne I've never seen. Ken Clark gets his milk from Nashville. And go home. But it's, you know, I think it's something I'm actually conscious of, because of course you find yourself sucked into a... I feel embarrassed almost saying that I come from a working class background, because obviously I've got two plays on the same effing street in the West End, and I don't pretend I'm working class now, but you know, my family's still working warehouses, and it's very important to me. I feel very lucky, actually. None of that. I'm so lucky that I had that experience, because I know it forms my plays in ways I'm sure I'm probably not conscious of.
Yes.
To what extent have you moved in political circles to help this characterisation plot?
To contradict exactly what I just said, all the time, I love moving in political circles, because I think you have to, and I was, again, just incredibly fortunate that the play I did at the National Theatre in 2012 called This House, for whatever reason, a lot of political guys came to see it, and they all came across the river, so I met Harry Harman, I met George Osborne, I met Nick Clegg, and they all came. And I was a bit of a tart. I just, whenever I met them, I made sure I got their contact details, and then would email them the day after. And because I want to, there's an opportunity there to access something which I think is so hard to access. So I wouldn't have been able to write. A few years later, I did a Channel 4 drama called Coalition, which was about the negotiations between the Lib Dems and the Tories to make a government. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I didn't have access to the people.
But originally it was maybe a work of imagination.
Exactly, yes. So This House, because no one knew who I was when I wrote that, that was really hard, because that was about the world of the whips, and parliamentary whips have a code of secrecy. So for those of you who don't know what whips are, they're the guys and girls who, they're members of parliament, but their job is to work in the House of Commons to get their party members through the House and vote the way that the leadership wants to vote. And normally that's fine in a majority, but in a hung parliament like we have now, it's very dramatic because it's very hard. They have a code of secrecy where they don't do any interviews, they don't go on television, they don't publish any memoirs. The first person to publish a whips memoir was Giles Brandwith. And he, the day of publication, he got a card through the post with a little black spot on it. And it was from the whips, and it was like, you're out, you're done. So when I knocked on their door and said, can you talk to me? They went, no. And it took a long, long time to get them to trust me. I don't know how, except I think if you generally go in with the best of intentions, they can sort of sense that. So eventually I got the 19th century whips to start talking to me, and we found all these new stories of things that happened during that time. Honestly, writing a letter is the most amazing thing you can do. It's people just assume that people won't talk to you. So I just put Nick Clegg, House of Commons, and put it in the postbox, and you'd be surprised how often people come back to you.
Yes?
You mentioned travelling, your inner hair. Who are your inspirational playwrights?
I'm very aware I'm following in a tradition that he made very popular and successful. I would say Alan Bennett, because I saw him in your book earlier. Yeah. People like that who have never believed that you can't write Northern working class voices without incredible intelligence but also great humour has always been important. Michael Frayn, Carol Churchill, and people writing now. I think it's impossible to go and watch a play. I'm seeing three new plays next week, and they will all absorb into me. That's my excuse for stealing everything. They all affect you, I think.
Yes. What if you talk a little bit about the beginning of your career and how you got your first play noticed and actually get it staged?
So I did a drama degree and then left university and weirdly, that doesn't help you to be a writer, because no one cares about qualifications when you're an artist. So I worked for about a year and a half on the stage door at the Theatre Royal in Nottingham, which was great, because I got to see different shows coming through as they toured from the West End. I just started writing, and I made huge mistakes at first. I just assumed that because I was 20 years old and I was writing dialogue, that I must be a genius. And all I had to do was churn out a few pages, put in an envelope, send it to the West Yorkshire Playhouse, and wait for the invite to opening night. And strangely, it never happened. So I just I calmed down a little bit. I spent 4 to 6 months on one single play. Just made that my absolute passion project, and that was Albert's Boy. And researched it diligently, didn't send off the first draft, did 4, 5, 6, 7 drafts, and sent. Then was really targeted about who I sent it to, so didn't send it away. But picked theatres, producers who have a history of that kind of work. And that was the first time someone called me back, the first theatre I sent it to. So, and that was the Finborough Theatre in London. And then you have to be smart about learning about the theatre ecology, learning what theatres do, what kind of work. Most regional theatres have a new writing department, and then most of them have Arts Council funding that subsidises the reading of plays, and that they sat there waiting for that. It's furiously competitive in London. I would say that the National Theatre gets over 1,000 plays a year. Less so actually in local theatres, and that's, I think that's a great place to start. And then you have to put a play on, and it's a catch-22, because often theatres won't put you on without an agent, but you can't get an agent without putting your play on. Mm-hmm. So things like the Edinburgh Festival are great to find amateur producers or young producers who want to put on your work. Fringe theatre, unfunded theatre, it shouldn't happen, but it does, and I needed it. And eventually you start to put a profile, and I got an agent. But ultimately, you have to keep writing, obviously. And you have to go and watch plays and read plays and be aware of what other people are doing.
Yes.
Sort of more about labour of love. When you've written a piece of theatre about politics that's so kind of unashamedly about one party or kind of one side of the story, how do you kind of put anything into the process to kind of ensure that it's not kind of feeding into a, you know, the echo chamber sort of thing? Because we saw it last night, and there was a sense of kind of being quite a Labour audience,
really?
Where we were in the balcony, back and right at the back. but there was, you know, like the minute Margaret Thatcher's image came on the screen, people properly hissed, boom, shouted out. There was this real sense of it being a certain side of the audience with a political leaning. And
okay.
Do you kind of put that into your process of writing at all?
No,
you
I
just
wouldn't.
Have to
I wouldn't.
Go with it.
I genuinely don't want that reaction.
Yeah.
I can't control it.
No.
But I yeah, it's that's but that's been happening a lot. I've noticed that myself. I guess the problem, acknowledged, never said, is of course that we all know that art and people who experience art, particularly theatre audience, can traditionally come from quite a narrow base politically. I think it's less than people think. With Labour of Love, I guess it's tricky because, as you identify, it's about one party, one part of the movement. So you may attract more people who are Labour supporters than the Conservative or anyone else. And they will have a visceral reaction to that kind of thing. I guess I hope with Labour of Love, and thank you for going to see it. And Martin was off last night, wasn't he?
He was,
I'm
yeah.
So sorry.
No, but Understudy was amazing.
Great.
He's such a good job.
Understudies should be, there should be a day where we celebrate.
Just, yeah.
He's, that's extraordinary that he did that. Martin hurt his leg doing the dance. Enough to say he was really struck down by illness, but no, he just twisted his leg, but he's going to be fine. And he's, what Martin actually went through in that cast change, he's an extraordinary actor. Sort of fall in love with him, he's brilliant. I think you accept that people are going to come with prejudice, they're going to come with baggage, there's nothing you can do about that. The joy of theatre, unlike almost any other medium, I think, is that it gives you the space and time and context to really absorb complicated ideas and walk in the shoes of people you disagree with. I think that more than anything else, I think it's a mix of being forced to physically sit in a community of people and for the actors to be live in front of you. It makes you more open-minded and more tolerant of dissenting views. And that's always the case. If you're a 12-year-old kid and you're shouting at each other on Facebook because you can't see their face, you see them in the playground the next day and something innate takes over, we become a better person. And you listen to them and they listen to you. And I think that's theatre's ultimate power. And it's not just the liveness of the actors, it's that you're physically next to each other. So you have a responsibility in a play like that to have the Margaret Thatcher moment where people throw vegetables, but then hopefully 3 minutes later you've found a quality of conversation that is more nuanced, and I felt the responsibility of that. And I hope an audience leaves, and I hope you will get to come and see it, an audience leaves with more questions than answers about their own political bias, I hope. But yes, it's tough. It is tough. Mm-hmm.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions. Anybody has? Yes, sir?
I was here a bit more about how you research this. Is it all conversations you're reading? And when you are researching, what are you looking for? Do you know what you're looking for? Or is it kind of...
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, because I think research, I love the research part of it, especially because often it's periods I wasn't born for. You have to trust on your sources. So the meeting people face to face is always the best thing. I love reading books, I love reading the memoirs and the biographies, but to go and meet people is a different quality of conversation. I have a rule in my head that I won't ever go and try to get them to tell me the thing that I need to hear to make my play work. I will ask them the questions, and if they tell me that it makes absolutely no sense what my hypothesis is, then I have to change it. And that just makes it relaxing. You just relax. You don't go to the Sun offices, and if people don't tell you this thing, then there's no play. You just go and listen. And I really believe that people can sniff it out. People smell in the quality of what you're asking, that you're not trying to trap them, and you're not coming in with an agenda, that you're genuinely coming in really curiously. And that was the only way I won the Whips around. The Whips, often because they were Labour people in the 1970s, so they were pretty tough. They were coming from the trade unions, and one guy was called Walter Harrison, and he's the main character really in this house. He was a legendary whip in the 1970s, Tony Blair said he was the only man he was ever afraid of. And I went up to his house. Well, actually I didn't, I was so scared of him that I put off talking to him, and then I lost control of the narrative because it got released that he was a character in the play. And he called me on my phone, and he had a proper go at me. So while half of him was going, "Oh God, I feel terrible," half of him was going, "I'm getting whipped by what?" Green light whip, and I was so sort of thrilled. So I went up to his house in Wakefield, and it took 10-15 minutes for him to trust me. But I knew my intentions were so honest and pure that eventually he did, and he started getting out all his photos, and he died 3 weeks later. So I just very, very quickly got stories that, this is not giving myself credit, but the stories that might have been lost because of it. So I think it's about your intention and your intent. But yes, meeting people is so much better than anything else.
It must be hard not to be swayed by what these people give you. I mean, for example, you met Stephanie Rahn, who was the first topless Page 3 model.
Yeah.
And she had some crazy stories that could have made it into ink.
Yeah.
But was it possibly completely derailed the story you were trying to tell?
I think, yeah, but I don't think that's any different from when you're making stuff up. I think you need to know what your central narrative is, and then it's the Noel Coward thing, if you have to kill your babies. You need to work out what your play's about, and anything that doesn't add to that central question, you have to discard, even if it's the best scene in the play, even if it's the funniest, the most moving scene in the play. So the Arthur Miller rule is that Arthur Miller would, on the top of his typewriter, write a sentence with a but in the middle. So Romeo and Juliet love each other, but I don't even know what that sentence would be, but their families are at war and they can't be together. Ideally it's thematic as well, so it speaks to a wider question you want to ask about humanity. And anything that deviates from that central question, even if it's really funny, look at the question and go, that's not the question. So it doesn't matter what, I mean, if she told me the question's wrong that I'm asking, I'd have changed the question. But you have to protect yourself a bit. But no, you also have to protect yourself about being seduced. I like people too much. And if people sit me down and give me a cup of tea, they're really nice to me. So I haven't met Rupert Murdoch yet. I've met the people around him and the people who were there at the time. But I'm glad, because I would have gone there, and I would have walked out, like, in love with them. I did the same with George Osborne, when in the television drama, he invited me to Downing Street, and I walked in a bit The first time I left, I was like the George Banker. Because he was just nice to me. So yes, that's probably a very specific problem with me, not playwriting.
Maybe it's time for a last question. Yes.
So you wrote this,
yes.
But after writing something else, would you ever, well, you said how much you had to change.
Oh, yeah.
So would you ever publish
previous
the original? Because I quite like the idea that you were putting forward in that of the that was going on.
As an experiment, maybe. As an academic experiment for the writers to see how a play works. But only as literature, never as theatre. I'd never let someone else do the early drafts on stage because we moved away from that for good reasons, I think. I went on a very lovely, brilliant journey with a play at the Old Vic a couple of years ago. Tennessee Williams, the play Sweet Bird of Youth, has a multitude of different versions, more than any other play, because they were actually performed. You would put them on at different venues and they'd be performed, and then they'd change them. But they exist in print. So I went to, I remember going to a library in Texas and uncovering all of his drafts to come up with a super version of this play, which I don't think I achieved. And it's brilliant as well because it was all his typewriting and he had whiskey on it and I could smell this and that. It was absolutely brilliant. So as an experiment for a student, yes, but I would never let anyone perform the first draft, I think, because...
But not even perform it, just publish it.
I mean, you do have a very different version of Ink here to the one we perform, actually.
But that's also true because eventually someone has to press print so that they can sell them in the show. Ultimately, though, this is why it's a classic copy that you can keep and sell for tens of pounds in the future. Ultimately, the version that starts being printed will be the one that we did. So for only a very short period of time, that exists.
And maybe just one last bonus question. Yes, you.
You've talked quite a lot, but obviously about all the real life events, real life people that you've dramatised from the very recent history with like Coalition and things like that. I was just wondering, is there any particular recent political events that make you very divisive, perhaps?
Sure.
Passage,
what are you talking about? It's been such a piece of my time. I don't know what you're talking about. Yes, I've just finished it. I'm doing a TV drama about the referendum campaign.
Yes.
I know, right? we've just got a director on board. It's going to be an American-British co-production, so it's going to be quite big budget. And I think it's based on two very brilliant memoirs books that were published about the campaign, and it just focuses on. I had a panic when I was writing it early this year that I just couldn't keep up because people kept triggering articles and things like that. So eventually, I just calmed down and stopped. Decided it would just be those 6 weeks of that campaign, and we have the inside view of those campaigns, and it's extraordinary. And again, my hope, it doesn't matter whether you're Leave or Remain, obviously it would be preposterous to project, I think, a viewpoint on that to a popular TV audience. But it looks at the battle between them. It was a very personal battle. There was such a strange amount of sabotage that they did. It was quite childish as well as important. So it's about those 6 weeks, and that will start shooting, I think, in January.
Okay, well, there's a lot to expect from you, James. We're all waiting hungrily for the next piece of political drama, or just human drama. For now, I think we'll take a drink break so we can all refuel. And then, if you've got a play, James will sign it, and you can have some photos and whatever, all that kind of fandom stuff. Right? Okay, everybody, thank you so much, James.
It's me again. That was James Graham in conversation with Jack Holden. So my thanks to both of them for that way back in 2017. But thank you also to you for listening to this, and I hope it was interesting and fun. Thank you to the Old Fire Station in Tunbridge for hosting it. And thanks also to Mr. Books Bookshop, who's effectively the kind of sponsor for this, I suppose. But there'll be more ideas in writing as we upload more, and as we get more recordings done with writers and interesting people. So do look out for it. It'll be on the Mr. Books website, mrbooks.co.uk, and here on whatever website or platform you found this. So thanks again, and see you next time.
All of my most sensitive areas were inflamed. My extremities pulsating with tingling sensation.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment. But it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts, so thank you very much.